I have the honor of welcoming you here this evening for our talk tonight on behalf of St. Joseph Catholic Radio. Again, I welcome you here. I thank you for coming. I hope you enjoy tonight's presentation by our speaker. We're privileged to have Dr. Alice von Hildebrand speaking tonight. And a little bit about her, Dr. von Hildebrand was born in Brussels, Belgium. She received her doctorate in philosophy from Fordham University. Author of Introduction to Philosophy and By Love Refined, she collaborated with her late husband, the famous philosopher Dietrich von Hildebrand, in the writing of Situation Ethics, Graven Images, and The Art of Living. Her most recent books include By Grief Refined and Women and the Priesthood. Since her retirement from Hunter College in New York, where she taught philosophy for 37 years, she has lectured and written extensively. Dr. von Hildebrand also serves on the board of the University of Franciscan University of Steubenville. And tonight, Dr. von Hildebrand will be speaking on the topic of secularism, Satan's attack on the church and the family. I hope you enjoy the presentation. Thank you for coming. Dr. von Hildebrand.
Dear friends in Christ, the topic I have chosen to discuss touches upon what I believe to be the most serious problem affecting the church today: the inroads made by secularism into the Roman Catholic Church and the loss of the sense of the supernatural. This is where the devil has succeeded best in sapping or trying to sap the foundations of the Church. I'm going to begin by a brief meditation on a very strange part of the Gospel of St. Luke, which it is related that Christ came to the country of the Gerasene, and there he met a man that was totally wild, running naked among the tombs, wounding himself with stones, screaming and scaring the whole countryside. And he came to Christ, and Christ said to the devil inhabiting this man, "Leave him." And he said to the devil, "What is your name?" He said, "My name is Legion, because there are many of us." And they begged Christ to allow them to go into a herd of swine that was nearby. Christ gave permission. The devils ran into the swine, who precipitated themselves, fell into the lake, and drowned. Whereas the man was liberated, he was healed, and he was kneeling at Christ's feet. But the amazing thing about this gospel is that when the Gerasene found out about this event, don't forget that for years they had been plagued by the presence of this vicious, sick man, possessed by the devil. And they came to Christ, and they begged him to depart. It is one of the most amazing things that you can possibly conceive of. How is it possible that a country, a group of people, threatened by someone who was dangerous, was possessed by the devil, and then Christ liberates him, and instead of thanking Christ, he said, "Please depart." Of course, if you take a purely financial viewpoint, you're going to say, well, of course, these people lost a lot of money. They lost a herd of swine. But I'm going to defend the theory that they beg Christ to depart because His Holiness constitutes a challenge that they did not want to meet. Now, you know full well that God has given us a nature. When he created Adam and Eve, he gave them a human nature, but he simultaneously gave them an extraordinary gift, which is called supernature, which is a participation of God's very life. And through original sin, this revolt against God, supernatural life was lost, and the gates of heaven were locked for us forever. And moreover, our human nature was severely wounded. And then through his sacrifice on the cross, supernatural life has been restored to man, provided that he's willing to collaborate with God's grace. But human nature remains wounded. Now, how did Christ save us? You can say, by his incarnation, his blessed incarnation, when he accepted to take the limitations and the imperfections of human nature, he accepted and chose humiliation, suffering, and death on the cross. Now, basically, you can say the way to reconquering supernatural life, or to have supernatural life blossom in us, is to follow Christ, which means to accept humiliation, which is a way to humility. You cannot be humble if you do not accept and endorse humiliation, suffering, and the cross. He who wishes to be my disciple should carry his cross. Now, all of us are willing to follow Christ to heaven. Very few of us are willing to follow Christ to Golgotha, to Calvary. In other words, the tragedy is that even though the Savior has come and is offering us the means of salvation, we are allergic to the cure. We do not like the means that Christ is giving us as means of salvation, humility, and the acceptance of the cross. Now, St. Augustine says, God who made us without us will not justify us without us. In other words, to be saved, to be justified, to reach heaven, we have to collaborate with God's grace. We have to open ourselves to God's grace. We have to become receptive to his message. And let me repeat once again, the way to heaven is humility, which implies the acceptance of humiliation and the way of the cross. Now, the early Christians were so overwhelmed by the discovery of the supernatural through Christ's personality, because Christ said in the Gospel, he who sees me sees the Father. And therefore, this confrontation, this vision of Christ was so overwhelming that many people, the apostles, the holy women, were won over by this radiant supernatural beauty, which was something transcending any human category. The supernatural is something that never entered man's head, because it comes from God. And they accepted it gracefully. They were willing to suffer and to die in order to become worthy of this incredible gift, to partake in God's life. It is said in the Acts of the Apostles that when the apostles were beaten because they were proclaiming the word of God, they rejoiced because they could follow Christ in his suffering on the cross. And then, as you know, Christianity slowly conquered Western Europe and Eastern Europe and the world. And slowly, by a process that I'm going to speak of tonight, a slow secularization. They lost sight of the incredible beauty of the supernatural, and all of a sudden started to get more concerned about the fact that the supernatural requires the transformation of man nature. And this implies suffering and difficulty, because man nature is wounded. It is wounded by sin. And because man nature is wounded, it does not like the cure offered to it. Let us acknowledge something very honestly and frankly. All of us fear humiliation more than anything else. I know people who would rather die than to be humiliated. And I mean, this is why it is so interesting today. For example, if you take the whole movement of feminism, I will no longer tolerate to be humiliated. And this is precisely a rejection of the message of Christ, who chose humiliation in order to save us. He who was God, who was divine, was spat upon and flouted and ridiculed and treated as a madman. He was a man of sorrow. And we would like to be redeemed by following the way of joy, peace, satisfaction, self-satisfaction, self-fulfillment. And this is why we resent the Christian message. Now, human beings are intelligent, even though their intelligence is definitely limited. Let us keep this in mind. But if I'm called upon to do something that I do not want to do, what is my intelligence going to do? In other words, I'm given an order by a legitimate authority, something that I know I ought to do, but deep down I don't want to do it. What do we all do? We're going to use what the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard calls unholy cleverness. It's a marvelous formulation, unholy cleverness. According to Plato, cleverness differs from intelligence. Basically, if I had to define intelligence, I would say intelligence is the capacity to distinguish between truth and error. That's all you need to be intelligent, to distinguish between truth and error. And may immediately remark that some people have very little education and are intelligent because they know what is black and what is white. You do not necessarily find this type of intelligence in universities. I know many people who have a PhD and major in confusion. You know, they sort of, you know, make a point of making things so confusing that finally at the end you no longer are certain that white is white and black is black. I'll give you an example that when I was at the City University and we were discussing the type of program that we should develop for freshmen in college. And I said, it seems to me that the most important thing that we have to start with is a question of truth. My chairman snaps back, whose truth? That is unholy cleverness. And of course, people immediately nick and say, well, you're making a very good point. Whose truth? Because what you say is not what I say. And after all, we live in a democratic society and there should be a multiplicity of views. There should be pluralism. Now, I'm all for pluralism when it comes to food. I don't see why everybody has to eat Italian food, which I happen to love, and they prefer French food. Well, I'm not going to, you know, to reject and say you ought to, everybody has to eat Italian food. This is what I call the Coca-Colaization of the world. Nonsense. But when it comes to the question of truth, pluralism is a great and dangerous evil. You cannot say in the name of pluralism, you have to say Christ is God and Christ is not God. You cannot say in the name of pluralism, abortion is perfectly legitimate or abortion is a mortal sin. there is one truth that we have to accept. Now we're going to try to see how can we escape from this unholy cleverness, which means to say to put our intelligence at the service of what we want. Now, I know people that are not particularly smart, but when it comes to defending their own interests, it's amazing how clever they can be. They immediately sense this sort of thing which is going to lead me to my end. And this is what we do towards God. We're going to use unholy cleverness to escape from doing what supernatural life expects us to do. And the first step, there are lots of steps. We're going to see there are basically four steps. There might be many more, but I'll limit myself to four. First step is to pay lip service to the supernatural, but carefully keep it away from your own personal life. In other words, you go to church on Sunday and you're going to recite the credo and believe in this and this and this and this and this and this and this. But on Monday, you forget all about it and you lead a life which is measured according to the norms of secularism, what everybody does. You see, that is a step number one, because, I mean, you say, of course I'm a Roman Catholic, of course I believe in the credo. What do you mean? You offend me. But you don't let it penetrate into your life and form your life. Another possibility is, of course, to water down revelation. You know, you can speak of the strong wine of revelation, because if you read the gospel and you take it very seriously, it is a very strong wine. And it's making demands upon us which go far beyond what a wounded nature would like to do. If you say, for example, someone slaps you on one cheek, offer the other cheek. Isn't that a little mad? Isn't that a little strange? I mean, after all, instead of saying you slap me and I'm going to take you to court, I'll sue you. This is what is happening in our society. Now, instead of accepting, or you say someone takes your cloak, you also should give him your coat. That strikes me as a little bit exaggerated. Wouldn't you say that it goes a bit too far? I mean, finally, I'm going to run naked and the person is going to have a cloak and a coat. That doesn't seem to be reasonable. And so what we try to do is to water it down. This strong wine of revelation is going to be watered down. Once again, the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard has formulated this magnificently. He says, Christ changed water into wine at Cana. Modern theologians do a lot better. They change wine into water, meaning to say that they keep adding the water of secularism to the wine of revelation, and they add so very much that at the end there's very little left of revelation and a great deal of what is called natural wisdom. That is one way of doing it. The other way is to reinterpret revelation, to read it in such a fashion that we accommodate it to purely worldly measures. And Kierkegaard has another marvelous formulation of this phenomenon that was already so widespread in the Protestant church in the 19th century and now unfortunately has invaded the Roman Catholic Church, that for centuries seemed to be protected from this sort of evil, and today has ruptured after Vatican II in such a fashion that we can say we are facing all the same problems that the Protestants were facing already in the 19th century, when there was this complete secularization. Now, Kierkegaard is going to formulate this way of reinterpreting the Bible. You read the Bible, and then you interpret it according to categories which are quite acceptable to your fallen nature. He says, people read the Bible and take the attitude of a boy who is going to be whipped. and puts very thick napkins into his pants so that he's not going to feel the blows. That's another way of doing it. Or there's also a way, which is very much practiced today, you hear it in homilies, to say, you know, the church is giving us an ideal. You know, of course it is ideal to be pure. But you know, men are men. What can you do? I mean, young people, I suppose, I mean, young men particularly, you have to let them sow their wild oats. It doesn't work otherwise. You have to be realistic. This is how human nature works. And so when people come along and say to you, you know, a sin of impurity is a very grave sin, keep in mind, my friends, that the church is a wise mother. She puts the clock an hour ahead of time. And therefore, if you come an hour too late, you still make it. And therefore, you know, you have this little adventure here and there, or you practice artificial birth control, and the church says, well, I grant you, it would be better if you did not do it. But of course, being given circumstances, you follow your own conscience. That's perfectly fine. You see, don't forget the church is setting the clock ahead of time. Now, therefore, there are all sorts of ways of escaping from the demand of the supernatural. And the supernatural calls upon a transformation of our nature. Our nature is a wounded nature. Our nature has to be cured and transformed down to the very end, to the very bottom. And this is what we resent. Now, the second step in this sort of watering down of the supernatural, this war on the supernatural, which at first is done in a sort of subtle fashion so that most people don't even notice that it's being done. You see, the most intelligent thing that you can do if you want to change something is to do so by small degrees. If you do so radically, people are going to notice it and say, what happened? This is not the church that I was used to. But if you introduce changes which are small, step by step by step, after a few years, and people are going to say, well, this is insignificant. This is unimportant. This is secondary. This is a ballast coming from the Middle Ages. Let's get rid of it. And after 4, 5, or 6 years, all of a sudden, you find yourself believing things that are totally different from what is taught by the gospel. A second step is very subtle. It consists in the fact that we praise the supernatural, but we praise it not because it is supernatural, but because we gauge it with purely naturalistic category. Let me give you examples. Take it from contemporary literature. Someone once gave a talk, not so very long ago, who wanted to say, refute the arguments of feminists that Catholic women are kept in a position of subjection and humiliation because they're given as model the Holy Virgin, who was very much in the background and never said a thing and was just obedient and was a gentle, soft sort of creature. And she thought she was going to give us a very powerful argument to try to show that it's not the case. And she said, just imagine, she becomes pregnant. And you know, a woman at the beginning of pregnancy is usually not feeling that well. And she immediately takes off and goes to Judea to visit her cousin. Now, do you imagine the distance between Nazareth and Judea at the time when there were no streetcars, no automobile, no buses, no means of communication? You went on foot, and the roads were bad, full of rocks. And there the Holy Virgin, though it shows that she's energetic, that she's dynamic, that she's very athletic, that she managed to cover long distances without fatigue or complaining. And on top of it, let us recall that when Christ was crucified, she was standing at the foot of the cross. That shows that she has quite a bit of vitality, doesn't it? What an offense to the Holy Virgin. Then you could sort of say, well, I know good many people in the world in which we live which would cover the distance from Nazareth to Judea much faster than the Holy Virgin. Are they to be praised more than the Holy Virgin because they run faster than she did? Do you see what I mean? They have taken a purely naturalistic standard, then applied it to the Holy Virgin, and then say, well, after all, I was praising her. Now that the Holy Virgin was holy, not because she was covering great distances at a fast speed, but simply because she had declared herself to be the handmaid of the Lord. That is the Holy Virgin's greatness. This is why she became God's mother. Not because she was efficient, not because she was energetic, not because she was athletic, but because she had this humility of the creature saying to God, I am the handmaid of the Lord, be done to me according to thy word. And in this very moment, the miracle of miracles, holy, the holiest of God, the Son of God himself, was conceived in her womb. It is as ridiculous to praise the Holy Virgin because she is dynamic and vigorous as to say, well, St. Peter was chosen as the first pope because he had the reputation of being the best fisherman in Galilee. He was a fantastic fisherman. He would catch more fish than anybody else. Then obviously it is quite clear that he was destined to become the first pope. I mean, what else could Christ do? Or to make something still more ridiculous than to say, well, St. Paul became the apostles of the Gentiles because he was a fantastic tent maker. It is stated this is how he was earning his living. He was making tents, and he was the best tent maker that you can imagine. So he could travel efficiently from one place to the other, always had a roof over his head. Therefore, he was ideal for traveling as much as the apostle of the Gentiles had to be. Once again, a purely naturalistic category applied to holy things. Why was St. Paul saintly? Not because he was a good tent maker, but because he said at the moment of his conversion, Lord, what will you have me do? Then he obeyed. This was St. Paul's greatness. He was, and in every epistle he says, God's servant. This was his title of glory. Not that he was a genius, not that his epistles were brilliant, not that he was a great intellectual, that he was God's servant. That is a supernatural measure. Or let me proceed. You know, the most popular of all saints, and possibly the most misunderstood, is Saint Francis of Assisi. And you hear people say that they love St. Francis of Assisi. He was such a jolly chap, you know, walking through the Umbrian hills, and he was singing French songs at the top of his voice. That is my type of saint, you know, not someone who is always somber and severe, but someone who is jolly. Now, suppose that we met someone who is jollier than St. Francis and who sings louder French songs. Would we say that he's to be canonized? It's perfectly ridiculous. Why was St. Francis such a great saint? Was it because he was jolly? No, because he had holy joy. And this holy joy was just a constant awareness in Francis' soul that Christ had saved the world. He kept praying, thank you for having saved the world. This is why he was happy. This is why he rated joy. This is why when he was beaten, when he was rejected, treated as a beggar, when his father, so to speak, kicked him out of his house, he was radiant because he had his father in heaven. Let us go further. Keep in mind the supernatural cannot be a human invention. It can only come from above. This is what converted my husband, whose background was completely atheistic. Both his parents were noble pagans. They were not practicing Christians in any sense of the word. And when he discovered the phenomenon of sanctity, when he read the life of St. Francis of Assisi, He said to himself, the church that can produce such fruits must be the true church. This is what happened to Edith Stein, you know, the Jewish convert. She read the life of St. Teresa of Avila. She started at 7 o'clock in the evening, read the whole night long. The next morning she said, I'm going to become a Roman Catholic. She discovered the supernatural. This comes from above. It cannot be produced by a human mind. And when the human mind encounters it, it dislikes it because it, so to speak, is a challenge for the human mind to be reformed, to be changed. The human mind, the human heart, the human personality must be transformed by the supernatural. And this is what we do not want, because you can only reach the supernatural by dying to yourself, dying to your wounded nature, by becoming what St. Paul calls in his epistle, become a new man. To be reborn, and you can only be reborn if first you die to your fallen nature. When I was at Hunter, at one particular moment, let us say about 15 years before I retired, there was a big discussion in the department whether we're going to open a department of religion. And we had to house it because the department was going to be so small that it couldn't be independent. So therefore it would be the Department of Philosophy and Religion. And all my colleagues, fallen away Catholics or Jews or atheists or liberals, you just name it, favored it 100 times. The only person against it was me. Oh, I thought you were a religious person, and how can you be against it? Because I knew exactly what was going to happen. They had one course on the Bible, and a student of mine took it. And the Bible was praised as being of great literary value. Not quite Homer, not quite Virgil, not quite Shakespeare, but quite good, and therefore worth reading. Not one single word was said about the fact that it was God's word to man. And then you read the Bible, and you totally miss its message. This is how secularization penetrates into people's lives, and then afterwards they say to you, oh, you know, the teacher praised the Bible as being a masterpiece. Don't you understand that it's an offense to the Bible to treat it from a literary point of view and to compare it to Shakespeare, to Virgil? It's on a totally different level. Either the Bible is God's word, or why should I bother? Then I say, well, I'd rather read Shakespeare or Virgil or Homer or Dante, whatever it might be. But this is what it claims to be, God's revelation to man. This was left out. And on top of it, the basic principle of the Department of Religion was to treat all religions on the same level. No difference whether you're Buddhist or Protestant or any branch of Protestantism or Roman Catholic. Even though Roman Catholic was very little mentioned, they had, for example, a course, and basically, Catholicism, or let us say Christianity, started in the 16th century. What happened before that was skipped over very, very rapidly. Of course, it was done on purpose. Now, you take Voltaire, one of the greatest enemies of the church in France in the 18th century. And one day declared, there's one saint who is to my taste. That is St. Vincent of Paul, because he was doing so much social work. Now, is St. Vincent of Paul canonized because he was doing social work? Then plenty of people in our society should be canonized, because wherever I go, I bump into social workers, meddling into people's life and giving advice why they should use the pill and so on and so on, or get divorced, or not have too many children to burden their marriage. Why was he a saint? Because his love of God was such that he learned to love his neighbor as Christ has loved them. And for this very reason, he went to the poor, of course, to relieve their suffering. You cannot be a Christian and be totally indifferent to other people's suffering, but to save their souls, to bring them to God. That was a supernatural message that he gave, and this is something that Voltaire could not care less about. He just saw the fact that he was feeding the poor, or he was burying the dead, or something of the sort. You take St. John Bosco, praised by people because he was such a great educator. And then he's compared to other famous educators. But what is left out is that he was educating people for eternal life. This is what he was trying to do. It was not simply because he knew the technique of education, because he had read textbooks on education, because he had a PhD in education, because he had taken 150 credits in education, but because he was burning with the love of God and wanted to help these young people to find their way to Christ. Left out. Recently, I put on the television, which I don't do too often, and I hear someone saying, my two heroes are Mother Teresa, and immediately my ears perked up, and then a television mogul, whose name I had never heard before, because these two people are such fantastic organizers. Now, if you dare praise Mother Teresa of Calcutta and a television mogul who has made something like $5 billion, and you put them on the same level because both of them are such efficient organizers, don't you understand that it's a terrible insult to Mother Teresa? Mother Teresa is not a great, extraordinary, saintly person because she's an organizer, but because she burns with love of God. And this is why she recognizes a suffering Christ in every single suffering school, which is probably the least concern of my television mogul. What does he care about that? He was probably a ruthless businessman, and to make billions of dollars in the world in which we live, my advice to you is be ruthless. Otherwise, you won't make it. Crush people right and left. Only consider your immediate advantage. And what happens to other people, who cares? That is a secularistic point of view. And then when you succeed, people will, of course, marvel at you because you've made it, because you're so rich, because you're so powerful, because you have so much money, because you have a private airplane. A few years ago, it was my ill fate to be on a panel discussion with a priest, who in the meantime is an ex-priest called Gregory Baum. And he was the first speaker, and I was the second speaker. And in his speech, he said, when I want to hear the voice of the Holy Spirit, I read the New York Times. Because then I hear the Spirit speaking through the news media. And I couldn't help it, you know, very impulsively. I sat and interrupted him and said, Father, I need smelling salts. I mean, just imagine this abominable, shameful confusion between the Holy Spirit, which is God's voice, and the Spirit of the time. Now, let me warn you, you know it as well as I do, that the Spirit of the time and the Holy Spirit hardly ever match. And you know, if the one great mission of the church is to go against the spirit of the time says so and so, there's a very good chance that in order to follow God, you have to go in the opposite direction. Otherwise, you are just going in the wrong direction. I was in Rome not so long ago and was invited for lunch at the North American College, and there was a nun. I didn't know that she was a nun because she wasn't dressed like one, but she had been teaching there for several months and she was leaving, and so they were giving some sort of a party in her honor. And, you know, they praised her and thanked her for what she had done, and then she took the mic, and I wasn't paying much attention, but all of a sudden I had something very strange. She said, oh, the holiest priest that I've met in my whole life was my own father. And I just said to myself, I must be slow, but how can her father be a priest? I had difficulties understanding, and they says, yes, he had such an outspoken social sense. Not a word about ordination. Not a word about the amazing gift given to priests to consecrate, to change bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. Not a word about absolution that a priest alone can give. If you come to me and say, I've committed adultery, and I say to you, I forgive you, it doesn't do you any good. Absolutely none. But if a priest says to you, you are forgiven, my son, in this very moment through Christ's blood, you know that your terrible sin has been forgotten. It's obliterated. Now, therefore, you have a nun telling us that actually, in order to be a good priest, all you should care for is to do social work. But then, why become a priest? And this is why I believe that thousands of priests have left the priesthood, because they've lost sight of the supernatural. If you lose sight of the supernatural, don't become a priest. Don't become a nun. Become a social worker. And then you'll be fishing in your own field. But in order to become a priest, you've got to understand the extraordinary privilege granted to you to become another Christ. Because the moment the priest is at the altar, independently of his own failures, he represents Christ. When he gives you absolution, he represents Christ. And if you lose sense of the supernatural, it doesn't make much sense. Why should people become priests? Why submit yourself to an authority that you're not going to obey in the first place? Last year, or a year and a half ago, an archbishop in the United States, whose name I'm not going to mention, but is one of the most famous dissenters in the church today, was invited to open a congress of some sort, a conference of some sort in New Zealand or Australia. And traditional Catholics wrote to the local bishop saying that they were very disillusioned that this man who is opposing the teaching of the Holy See should be invited to open this congress. And the bishop was irate. And he wrote a letter in the church bulletin saying, I was shocked that some people objected to the invitation that I made to so-and-so. My dear friends, don't you know that he's a great linguist and plays the piano beautifully? That's a quote. Now, I'm convinced that Arthur Brendel plays the piano better than this particular archbishop. Does it mean that therefore he should open a conference given to Roman Catholics in New Zealand? I mean, you see this total, and then when you see he was a great linguist, I say to be a great linguist is a tramp, my friend. It's a lot better if you can speak various languages. But I fear that in hell, all tongues are spoken. That's my great fear. You know, in other words, the fact that you speak a particular language doesn't guarantee that you're not going to go to hell. No, it just shows you that this invasion of secularism into our life has gone so efficiently, step by step by step, that many of us, many of you, and possibly myself included, are certainly won over and say, well, you know, these people are basically not anti-Catholic. They praise Mother Teresa. Or they are not anti-Catholic because they praise, they like the style of St. Augustine. They say St. Augustine writes beautifully, which he does. There is an abyss between nature and supernature, even though nature is called upon to be transformed by supernature. Now, at any rate, you can now understand that step by step by step, the supernatural is being undermined. And this is getting to be very, very serious. The third step is actually when we see the natural as being, so to speak, a prelude to the supernatural. You know, in other words, that you see the difference between nature and supernature is only a difference of degree. So therefore, when you become a very, very, very good social worker, you reach charity. In other words, to be a good, efficient social worker already reaches the supernatural, and therefore the next step is charity in the supernatural sense. And say the most efficient social worker who sees most clients, who is most efficient at reporting their cases, is not one inch closer to the supernatural, because the two things are incomparable, because the supernatural comes from above. Therefore, once again, you see how slowly, slowly, slowly the supernatural is eliminated, and it's eliminated because we don't want to live up to its demands. When my husband, shortly after his conversion, started teaching at the University of Munich, he looked at every single priest as being ordained and therefore being placed on a higher level than we are, quite independently of what he is as a person. You know, even if a priest is not a good priest, nevertheless, because he is a priest, there is something in him that calls for respect. We have to respect his dignity as priest, even though he might be a miserable human person as man. Now, for this reason, in order to show his faith, my husband, who had several students that were young priests, and every time they passed the threshold, he would say to the priest, "Father, go ahead of me." And this was noticed by one of his colleagues, who called him and said, "Professor van Hillebrand, your behavior strikes me as very odd. I've noticed that again and again you let your students step ahead of you." To which my husband said, "Yes, but they are priests." And his colleague looked at him horrified. He says, "Yes, but they have no PhD. Now, this is related in my husband's memoirs. What does it show? That for this man to be a PhD, to have a PhD, is higher than to be a priest. But therefore, you see now, nature is placed above supernature. It's much more important if you are a PhD, a hair doctor, then obviously you call for respect. But I mean, if you're only a priest, I mean, after all. Now, this dear professor with a PhD forgot that, surprisingly enough, Christ chose fishermen as his apostles. As far as I know, none of the apostles had a PhD. I mean, you see, you know how ridiculous that is. I mean, if you start drawing the conclusions. Or there was a professor, a Catholic, a good man, who saw that my husband was an ardent convert, and he warned him that he had to be careful when he was teaching at the university not to ruin his chances of promotion. And he said to him, "Dear Professor van Hillebrand, can I give you a piece of advice? When you start teaching, don't you ever use the word religion. I suggest that you replace it by the word metaphysics. It is so much more respectable." This in a university when there was a majority of Catholics among professors. Once again, the supernatural is sort of, you push it aside. You are somehow ashamed that you accept something which is not proven by reason, because reason becomes supreme in the university. Faith is considered to be for weak-headed people. Now today, the attack on the supernatural has reached its climax. It's step number 4. And what is it? Open dissent, a rejection of the authority of the Pope. The Pope says something, let this old man, this old Pole, say what he wants. We, the American church, are going to do, follow our conscience. We are going to do as we please. In other words, today you just notice that it's an all-out attack, not only on the dogmatic teaching of the church, but mostly on the moral teaching of the church, even though, once again, because of unholy cleverness, people don't like to acknowledge that this real difficulty is a moral difficulty, and therefore they're going to find intellectual difficulties, because it is much more respectable to have intellectual difficulties. A priest that my husband and I knew years ago once told us that he knew a young man. He had known him ever since he was a child, and one day this young man, brought up and raised as a Catholic, and said, "Father, you know, I feel that in all honesty, I have to leave the Roman Catholic Church because I have enormous difficulties accepting transubstantiation. He was about 17. And this priest, who was down-to-earth Englishman, said, "Now, Mark, have you been sleeping with a girl?" He said, "Yes, Father." He said, "That's your problem." And it was. But don't you understand if you say, "I want to leave the church because I don't want to follow her moral teaching," well, you acknowledge defeat. In other words, you are not strong or courageous enough to follow the teaching of the Church. But if you say, "I have difficulties about transubstantiation," well, this is an intellectual problem, and of course, it's rather complicated, is it not? And therefore, it seems to be justified. Now, therefore, once again, we find this duplicity in man's soul, that instead of openly saying to God, "I don't want your law," what we try to do to escape from it. But we escape from it century after century after century, because this goes back to the Renaissance. Today, there's an absolute and total break. And I mean, as I said, we've got to face the fact that there's a big chunk of so-called Catholics who are no longer Catholics. But they call themselves Catholics, so they remain in the church because, as they said very openly, "We want to change the church. We don't want to leave the church, we want to change it. And if we leave it, we cannot change it. We want to reform it." And they forget that their reformation is going to be a deformation, because it is actually an abolition of the supernatural. The supernatural bothers us because it makes demands upon us that we don't want to live up to. I mean, this is why, for example, you notice the very tragic case that today people declare that they have come of age. They are mature. You know, of course, for centuries, people were still fairly immature, and then obviously it was good for them to get some sort of directives from Rome. But once you are mature, then you no longer need to obey. You can make your own decisions. Now, all parents among you know full well that when a child declares that he has come of age, he has started the crisis of puberty. Puberty crisis starts the very moment that a young boy declares, "I'm not mature enough to make my own decisions." Beware, that is a moment of danger. And the wise person, you read the rule of Saint Benedict, that he says that the abbot, and the abbot is usually not a young man, when important decisions are to be made, he must ask for advice. We all need advice, even if you're over 70 or even 80. We are still capable of making stupidities if we rely upon our own strength. Turn to advice to people who know better than you do. And all of a sudden, modern man says, "We've gone to the moon, we have invented the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb, we can blow up the world. We are so great, so amazing, so remarkable, we no longer need the instructions coming from Rome." And that is a danger today. You know, this sort of intellectual arrogance to believe that we know better. Now, this, of course, is going to have a two-pronged attack. You know, I could talk about this for hours, but I mean, my time is limited. And so I'll say to myself, one of them is an attack against celibacy. The celibacy of priests must be abolished. Why should priests have a normal life? Why should they have wives? I mean, after all the sexual scandals happening in the church could be easily solved if priests were permitted to marry. On top of it, there's a shortcoming of priests, and therefore it is absolutely indispensable that priests should be able to marry, and then we'll get more. And then if we accept the ordination of women, just imagine this very moment we're going to find out that most people become priests. And we're going to have a problem having faithful, because everybody's going to be a priest. And I mean, it's if everybody becomes a taxi driver, when you're going to find no one that you can drive. You know, this is going to be a situation. Now, why this attack on the celibacy of priests? Because once again, secularism, headed by Freud, has convinced us that you're a crippled human being if you have no sexual life. You are intellectually crippled, you are affectively crippled, you are physically crippled. Man's may is made to reproduce and therefore to artificially say to someone, you cannot become a priest unless you lead a life of celibacy. This is just going to cripple people. And after Vatican II, thousands of priests said, my goodness, I'm a crippled person. And in order to become normal, I have to, you know, to leave the priesthood, which they did, got married, and usually got divorced a few weeks afterwards. Let me tell you something. What is the meaning of celibacy? Why is the church requiring celibacy? Because the church has such a high understanding of the unique calling of priests. The priest is someone who is going to represent Christ. The priest is someone called upon to give himself completely and totally to God. And very much as in marriage, you give yourself to another person completely and totally by allowing him to penetrate into your intimacy. So the priest who gives himself totally and completely to God seals this intimacy as a gift to God. And therefore it is symbolic of its total, complete, absolute donation to God. And to say that human beings cannot live without a sexual life is one of the most greatest stupidities that I ever heard in my life. You know, celibacy is not life-threatening. Keep this in mind. You know, as a matter of fact, if you turn to the Carthusians, you know, I am privileged to know the prior of the Carthusians in Vermont, and three times I was allowed to visit him. And he has priests living to 70 and 80 and 85, and they are celibate. You don't die from it. As a matter of fact, you might live a lot longer, which is not a way why you should become celibate, by the way. If you said, I want because, I find out that if people lead a celibate life, they live long, therefore I'm going to remain celibate. That's what I call evocation. You see, and therefore, once again, the moment you lose sight of the supernatural, why become priest? And priest left the priesthood because they lost the sense of the supernatural. Now you notice on the other hand that the new orders like the legionaries of Christ that are faithful to the teaching of the church draw innumerable vocations. And the orders that are decadent and have become secularized, they're dying out and they deserve to. You know, therefore, when an order is truly living up to the demands of the church, it flourishes. The very moment it says, well, everybody can do what he pleases, when the Jesuits in Fordham have a cocktail at 5 o'clock, 5:30 every single day, then you're not surprised, they're dying out. They have no vocation, and they should not have vocations because you can only have a vocation if you realize a tremendous gift of the supernatural and trusting in God's grace. You know that you can transform and totally elevate your nature. You know, the second attack, and this is something that I discussed yesterday, so I'm going to pass upon it very rapidly, is feminism. Then all of a sudden, contemporary women have discovered that they have been mistreated by the church, that they have been considered to be second-hand citizens, they have pushed aside, they have been dominated by males, and so on and so on. This can only happen. I mean, I don't deny that some women have been abominably treated. I don't deny that some men, because they're also affected by original sin, have abused of their physical strength and have mistreated women. I don't deny it. There are terrible things which have happened. And Chesterton mentioned it, and I mean, all reliable authors recognize it. But what I would like to say is that these women, feminists, by definition, have lost the sense of the supernatural. In her autobiography, Saint Teresa of Lisieux says that when she was traveling in Italy, she went to Italy once before entering the convent, and she says, wherever you travel, you say, women cannot enter here. A woman will be excommunicated if she steps here, and so on and so on. And then she comments and says, women are not well treated. And it seems to be an injustice, except if you realize that they follow Christ to Calvary, and that Christ is a God who was flouted, ridiculed, spat upon, and crucified. And it is their very special privilege, the very moment that you look at humiliation, the very moment that you look at it as a grace of following Christ. You cannot follow Christ if you don't follow him to Calvary. Then you realize that women have some sort of a privileged position because in some way they're sharing particularly in the mystery of the cross. The question is, how are we going to regain the supernatural? And I mean, this is a crucial question today. We have lost it. We just have to face it. Priests have lost it. Nuns have lost it. Bishops have lost it. You know, it's only in the individual people that you get to say the supernatural is still very much alive. And I say the way of regaining or reconquering the supernatural is, of course, by supernatural means. Prayer, penance, the sacraments. That is a way of doing it. You know, to reanimate our faith, to make constant acts of faith in the presence of Christ in the Blessed Sacrament, in the incredible gift of receiving Holy Communion, that our Lord comes to us and offers us his body, and it invites us to be transformed in him. But there are also means that I would like to mention. Because it seems to me that today one of the very tragic things happening in our society is that many people who work for the church and do a good work for the church nevertheless lose sense of the supernatural, and for this reason do not achieve the transfiguration of their work which they should possibly achieve if they had a more supernatural outlook. One of the things that I have noticed to my great sorrow, and I travel a great deal, and this is something that I see, since Vatican II, and particularly in the course of the last 15 years, all sorts of very good Catholic organizations have developed in defense of life, in defense of tradition, in defense of the Trinity Mass, in defense and so forth and so on. Many of them, and they're good. And all of them are truly aiming at defending the church. But I've discovered something which is so very strange. The rivalry between some of them. That both, I mean, let us say, there are two working pro-life. And they keep attacking each other and trying to convince you that one organization is good and the other one should be rejected because they're so much better and they do things so much better, and on top of the other one has done so and so and so and so. If we start fighting each other instead of collaborating, it seems to me everybody working for God's glory should be encouraged, which doesn't mean that I have to involve myself in it. But why this sort of intestine fighting between people working for the same aim? Then I've noticed, and this is something that I say to my great sorrow, that when people work for the church, they put a great deal of their own ego into it and become very, very ambitious. They want to succeed because it is their work. They cannot take a defeat, even though you can only say that from a supernatural point of view, to accept a defeat which is accidental, which I have not caused myself, can be a tremendous step towards holiness. I mean, after all, let us not forget that Christ's life ended with the terrible defeat of the cross. He was crucified and he died, and everything seemed to be over. And after 3 days came the resurrection. So therefore, we've got to realize from a supernatural point of view, you can gauge your faith by seeing how you face a defeat. And I notice that many people, they want success, they want achievement, and they want to make sure that they get recognition. That was my work. I did it. I achieved it. It is thanks to my own effort. Let us keep in mind that it is said in the Gospel of St. Luke that if we've worked, you know, the whole day in the fields, and then we come home, and the master says, prepare my meal. And then I prepare his meal before I take my own meal. I'm nevertheless a needless servant. Let us keep this in mind. In some way, you can see that some people working for the church with good intentions misinterpret the words of St. John the Baptist, May he increase and I decrease. And they say, may he increase, but I with him. You know, this is a typical secularistic temptation. This works in business. It doesn't work in supernatural life. If you have an organization, I have a similar organization. You succeed and I'm defeated, but somehow the church is served. It should make no difference to me that you succeeded and I was defeated. You know, and some people sort of say, well, I want to achieve it because it is my work. And therefore this enormous egotism, which is put in the supernatural world. Now, this is not going to achieve mystery. It's not going to achieve holiness. We absolutely need this inner purification in our work. I do it, my God, because I believe it is your will. If it is not your will, I accept defeat. St. Ignatius of Loyola said shortly before his death, he had spent 35 years building up the Jesuit order. And he said, if all of a sudden my whole work would collapse, I don't think it would take me more than 10 minutes to be totally at peace. Because he knows that out of the ruin, Christ can rebuild another order. He's not needed, I'm not needed, I have to work full time. But realize that it's not my effort or my accomplishments that count, it is my humility, my spirit of devotion, my love for God and His church. This is what counts. There's another thing that I've noticed. You know, that suppose that I work for an organization which is a good and noble organization for the church. And then I become so concerned about this one aim that I identify the church with my work. The church is my work. And for this reason, I can become absolutely ruthless towards other organizations working for other things that are also serving the church. Let me try to express it in very simple language. There are people so devoted to serving the blind that they find perfectly justified in being ruthless to the deaf. They don't care, that's not my business, I only care about the blind. Instead of understanding the Catholic spirit, it's this openness to any cause which is for God's glory. Now, I'm going to end with a very, very sensitive question, very sensitive topic. What should the Christian attitude be towards our leaders? Because wherever I go, I hear people complaining about their bishop or about their priests or about people who are religious leaders. Why don't they do so and so? Isn't it incredible that they allow so and so? This is happening constantly, and it is a reason for concern. I have done a great deal of thinking about this. And the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced that if you read the Bible very carefully, you're going to see that Christ never promised, never once, that we're going to have perfect leaders. Never. But he did promise that the gates of hell shall not prevail. Now, as a matter of fact, God makes strange choices. You read the Old Testament and you find out that when God wanted the Hebrew people to be liberated from Egypt, whom did he send to Pharaoh? Moses. And what did Moses say? My Lord, I have a speech defect. I stammer. Send somebody else. I would have sent Demosthenes or Cicero and say, you know, that's going to make it. And you have someone who stammers and he's supposed to go to the most powerful man on earth to convince him to let the Jewish people go. And God said, go. And he succeeded. It's a very strange choice. Now, you take when I was a little girl, and you know, going to a Catholic school, and a Catholic school in my time was a Catholic school. We had 1 hour of religion from the first grade to the end of high school, every single day, including Saturday. And I was very upset because when Jacob died, he chose Judah as the ancestor of Christ and not Joseph. And I love Joseph. Just imagine, I mean, his brother trying to murder him, and then he was this noble and good man, and then he became this famous man, and he saved his family from starvation, and he forgave them. And I loved Joseph. He was my ideal. And I said, of course, Joseph is going to be the chosen one. No. He chooses Judah, who wanted to murder Joseph. I don't understand. But God knows what he's doing. So once again, you can say, don't apply a naturalistic method to God's choices. Then you take the first pope. The first pope is Saint Peter. And at the Last Supper, he said to Christ, you know, everybody will abandon you. I will die for you. And he was quite sincere. And Christ said, before the cross crossed three times, you would have denied me three times. 3 hours afterwards, 3 hours, because of the remark of a maid, he shakes in his shoes and he says, I don't know that man. And he's chosen as first pope. As a child, I recall saying to myself, you know, we're discouraged from raising questions or being dissenters. But I said to myself, he should have chosen St. John. And he said, the apostle whom he loved. And he chose St. Peter. Why? Because God's ways are not our ways. Because God knows what he's doing, and if the church is saved, it's not because of an individual pope or bishop, even though we've had some very great popes, even though we've had some very holy bishops. It is because God saves his church. Let us keep this in mind. And therefore, when we say things are desperate today, they look so bad, the bishops are impossible, and so forth and so on. But God has not abandoned his church. I think that he's sleeping in the boat. And the moment that he wakes up, he will say one word, and there would be a great calm. Let me end by relating an historical fact which is worth meditating upon. The 19th century, early 19th century, as you know, Napoleon had conquered Europe. And he knew that in order to achieve complete victory, he had to conquer and dominate the Roman Catholic Church. And so he went to Rome, imprisoned the Pope, Pius VII, and brought him to France, and he was locked up in France for 2 years. And after having humiliated him and intimidated him, Napoleon came and brought the Secretary of State a concordat. And he said, give this to His Holiness, I'll come back tomorrow and I want it signed. And the Secretary of State, whose name was Consalvi, read it, and he said to the Pope, Your Holiness, you may not sign this concordat. It is selling the church into the hands of Napoleon. Next day, Napoleon comes back and says, give me that concordat. And Consalvi says, Your Majesty, you may have it, but it's not signed. Then Napoleon tried one of his typical tricks. He went into tantrums, and he started screaming and shouting, if you don't sign that concordat, I'm going to destroy the Roman Catholic Church. Consalvi answers very calmly, Your Majesty, if popes and cardinals and bishops and priests have not succeeded in destroying the church in 1900 years, how can you expect to do so in your lifetime? Well, that is a situation that we are facing. There is no room for optimism. There's plenty of room for hope. Hope is supernatural. Optimism is secularistic. You're optimistic when you live in California and you have lovely weather and you have a good time and life seems to be lots of fun and, you know, things are going to get better and better and we'll make more and more money. It comes from above. It is a response to God's infinite goodness, infinite mercy, infinite love, who is going to save us if we turn to Him. I grant you the situation is bad. I grant you the situation is extremely serious. As I said, I believe that Christ is sleeping in the boat, but He's leading us to Calvary. But let us not forget that behind Calvary shines the light of the resurrection. Thank you.